The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I'm going to ask you a minute to pair off, and we'll take maybe 15 minutes or so to study. But before I do, I just want to give you the briefest of introductions, okay? What interests me the most is that very often, with Jewish role models, it seems as though I don't really have a chance to get an introduction. In other words, what's going to happen now, you will notice, is precisely the opposite of the perspective that I'm given to begin with in the story of, say, Abraham, right? When Abraham comes on the scene, except for a verse mentioning his birth and who his father was, when Abraham comes on the scene, he comes on the scene with the relationship that he's developing with Hashem, with God. Moshe is quite the opposite. Moshe has a good couple of chapters, or whatever it might be, before God even enters the scene. And it would seem to me that this must be an introduction to who Moshe is. Maybe even an introduction to why Moshe becomes who Moshe becomes. Taking into account the introduction I gave you to Torah when we were first looking at this, this must somehow be significant for me. So that's my underlying question. Who is Moshe? Why is Moshe so important? How does Moshe become Moshe? We tend to look at finished products. And we miss tremendous opportunities by not analyzing how we arrive at those finished products. I look whatever my goal is, whatever my ideal is, and I see that ideal before me. If I can figure out how that ideal was accomplished, then I can inculcate that ideal into myself. So that's what I'm looking to take a look at. Okay? So let's take a look before we get into this, all right? And what I want you to do, there are chumashim in front of you, is open up to page 63. Okay, so what'd you see? Let's see what you saw. On a scale of 1 to 10, by the way, just out of curiosity, okay? 1 being not much to see here, 10 being there is so much in every verse, I don't know where to begin. Scale of 1 to 10, what would you call this particular section?
10.
10, right? So I want to tell you a secret. But if you're starting to feel, if you take a chance now, somebody wants to ask me, like, how do you ever get there? Like, there's so much to study. And the more you study, the more you realize how you don't know. Take a look back. You've been here now, what, a week? And think about, I mean, I can only tell you that I'm watching you. And I'm just seeing the difference between today and a week ago. And if you're sensing that now, looking back at how you look at this section today, and how you looked at a section the first time we did it, it has nothing to do with someone sharing with you all this incredible skills and methodology and whatever. It's just a function of doing it. If you go for a run, the first day you go for a run, you ache. The seventh day you go for a run, it's a little easier. So whenever you sort of feel daunted by the prospect of pursuing these issues, whatever they might be and however you choose to do them, if you choose to do them, just realize there isn't some magical secret. It's just like Nike says, you know, just do it. Okay? Anyway, so let me see what you saw.
Well, there's three women who are guiding Moshe's life.
Very good.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. Who, by the way, is missing here?
His father.
Who's missing?
The father.
The men. It's all women. Did you notice that? It's the mother, it's the sister, it's the daughter of Pharaoh. Moshe's early beginnings, if you think about it, Moshe's brought up as a mama's boy. He's a wussy. He's just got women everywhere. There's no men. Interesting. We'll get back to that. By the way, don't give me any answers. Don't give me any what you think of. I'm looking now for what you know, okay? Or questions you have, yeah.
And out of all the three women, none of them show any emotion and none of them have any names.
That's very interesting. What I have to add one addendum. Let's see if somebody else picked this up because you're right. I don't see what they feel, but I do notice something else, yeah?
Compassion on him.
Verse 6, right?
Yeah.
Vatachmol alav.
She took pity on him.
Good.
And this is one of the Hebrew boys. So she could have just, you know, there was like this thing that if there was a Hebrew boy, you would kill him.
Oh, so this is great. Now appreciate this, by the way. Because we're going to have to understand this. Here I have a mother and a daughter who somehow, or at least the mother, who I would think represents pity and mercy and compassion, who overcomes her mercy and compassion, or maybe this is a function of her mercy and compassion, I don't know, but it seems to be missing. I don't see, you know, I would expect, I mean, if I was writing a drama, this is it, you know, this is like the dream, this is the role every actress dreams of, putting my child onto the river, into the clutches of the Egyptians. That's the big tearjerker. So I expect the verse to tell me, and Yocheved did place him on the Nile, and she did bawl, she did cry. She gazed out upon the water with a stony look. You know, you would have like a parenthesis for the screenplay, right? I don't find that. Who do I find finally having mercy, daughter of Pharaoh? By the way, what is daughter of Pharaoh doing when she finds Moshe?
Bathing.
She's bathing. Where is she bathing?
In the Nile.
What's the Nile?
God.
The Nile is one of the seven gods, in fact, the chief god of Egypt. It represented, you know, we don't have time to go into this now, some of you have heard me speak about this, but paganism essentially, idolatry, what is idolatry? Traditional paganism, idolatry was the worship of nature, was the worship of the cruelty of nature, the power of nature, the majesty of nature, awesomeness of nature. The Nile was that part of nature which the Egyptians felt, and the worship of nature very often is the worship of self-gratification. I worship the rain because it brings me food. So the Nile was the god of Egypt. It provided them with sustenance. So she's bathing in idolatry, when you think about that. And it is in this process, who ultimately saves Moshe? Not just someone who isn't of his family. Not just someone who isn't of his people. But this is like the antithesis. I mean, this is the daughter of Pharaoh. This is like super idol worshiper. In the process of bathing herself in idolatry. You know, think about this. She's the daughter of Pharaoh. Does she need to go down to the river to bathe? No. She gets 50 slaves. They all come up with a pitcher. She gets 5,000 slaves. They all come up with a pitcher. And they stand in a line and they just pour over her until she finishes her shower. I promise you she didn't have to go down to the Nile to bathe. I don't know if you've ever been to the Nile. I've never been to the Nile. But I've been to rivers, big rivers, little rivers, swamps. Okay? I don't know. Maybe they had a special daughter of Pharaoh bathing section. It's a little gunky to go into the Nile. So I would have thought she wouldn't go to the Nile. So that's not an accident. She's really immersed in it, up to her neck, and this is how Moshe gets discovered. It's a little strange. What else? Yeah.
Well, just to develop that more, I'm seeing love and concern in the act of the sister following Moshe down
river. Ooh, now that gets interesting. That gets interesting. So you see there's a process here? Do you see that? Now we're going to have to think about that.
So the emotions are like hidden.
There's something there. No, actually, the emotions are not hidden. You have to know where to look. I'm going to clue you into that in a minute. Lots of threes here, aren't there? Three women, 3 months. We're going to see that there are three men. Interesting. Three, by the way, I mentioned once to you numbers. We didn't get into it. But the number three is the minimal number that signifies that something is significant. It's not like the number six, which means that, you know, there's something incomplete. 6 days of the week are incomplete because I don't have Shabbat, etc. The number three just means, you know, if I put 3 points on a blackboard, if I put 2 points on a blackboard, any way you put them, you're going to have the same line. But if I put 3 points on a blackboard, then each point is significant. So three is significant. Okay? Whatever that means. Yeah.
Why did the Star of David have to use this?
Okay. The Star of David, in fact, is missing something. But in order to express that to you, I'd have to explain to you what the Star of David is. It would take me about an hour. So Star of David, where it comes from, what its significance is. Suffice to say, the Star of David represents the power that I as a human being have to contribute to this world. And I, in this world, always have to feel that that's missing something. It's missing my relationship with God. I have to remind myself that I'm never the be-all, end-all. I'm a partner. And it's good that I'm a partner, but let's put that aside. Yeah.
It kind of struck me that Moses is growing up in the kingdom of Pharaoh and was nursed by a Jewish woman and given over to Pharaoh's daughter. And even though he had the whole kingdom and all the resources of the kingdom at his disposal, he somehow had the internal strife, or whatever you call it, to go out and slay an Israelite in the name of Hebrews.
Okay. Doesn't that story seem like it pops out of nowhere?
Yeah.
Like, here's Moshe. You know, it's like you see this idyllic music, and the little baby was in the crib, and the mother was nursing him. And then he went out and saw two men fighting and killed them. And then he went back to the fields and became a shepherd. It's like someone got the wrong script, you know, they threw the screenplay on the desk, it didn't work, right? That's a little strange. So you now have a central responsibility to remind me of that point when I get rolling. Yeah.
Okay, also, I think it's saying that there's something about Moshe, because, first of all, it says that the woman had the child and saw that it was good. Obviously, most mothers think their children are good.
Ooh.
And then, Pharaoh's daughter, after having him nursed by this, you know, Hebrew woman, still wants the kid. Like, why bother? Okay, you have compassion, make sure the kid's fed and taken care of. Fine, why does she want this kid as her son? So there must be something.
Okay, you have just taken a step down a path that is the path of the Sfat Emet. It took me, I have to tell you, about 10 years in yeshiva to get to begin that path. So, you're ready? Okay. Yeah.
There's this continuing thing.
Should think about rabbinical school this morning. But anyway, okay, yeah.
There's this continuing thing about water, too, which usually indicates a change of status.
Ooh. Okay, there's a lot of water here, isn't there? Did you notice that? There's a lot of water?
Mm-hmm.
Just out of curiosity, where's the big place that I see water in the Bible? The flood. And what happens with the flood? How is mankind saved with the flood?
With the boat, same way that Moshe.
With the boat, right? Noah is saved by being in an ark. Noah is the bombastic. Noah is the whole big story with all of creation. Everything is in the ark. Moshe is the microcosm, somehow. Almost as if to say, do you remember I was discussing in class that there was a certain point when God wanted the whole world to be a happy family. We had the potential to do that. When Adam and Eve came around, everyone in the world essentially came from Adam and Eve, biblically speaking. Whether literally or allegorically, but biblically speaking. And then again, with Noah. Noah was the father, Noah and his wife were the parents of all mankind. It didn't work. So comes along Abraham onto the scene, and I told you, v'nivrachu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama, Abraham, rather than being found by God, has to find God himself. And God finally says to Abraham, it's not working. The whole world together, it doesn't work. So you're going to be a role model. You be a role model, and through you, maybe the world will be able to sense, attain, see, find, develop ethics, goodness. Moshe would seem to be the stage continuing from Abraham. Because whereas Noah is the big story with everything in it, Moshe is just Moshe on the ark. Very interesting. By the way, just out of curiosity, what does a baby represent as opposed to a man?
Potential.
Right? This story has the root of potential in Judaism. There is so much potential going on here. Now, what water is an interesting thing. I won't get into it in depth. It's interesting that here the Kabbalah and physics agree. Water is that item which has no shape, right, in the physical world. It is shaped by whatever vessel it's in. And that's why salvation somehow seems to come through water, because the question is what I do with it. There's a lot more to that. It's interesting that blessing in the Bible and the land of Israel is always represented by rain. Right? But okay. But it's good that you notice that, even though I have to be honest with you, we're not going to really get to it. Anybody else? Yeah?
Yeah, and there's what fascinates me is this whole business about identity, people not knowing who they really are.
Now that's interesting. How does Moshe become Moshe? That's my root question. Okay, I hear that.
How did he know he was Jewish?
Pardon?
How did he know he was a Jew?
That's also a good question. By the way, does it say anywhere that Moshe saw his brother the Jew? Doesn't say that.
No.
Not that I know of.
It
just says his brother. He sensed a kinship. I'm not so sure that the issue was that they're Jews. I think that might have come later. Okay, so let's get rolling. Yeah, last chance. Rebecca.
How can you murder someone and then be the guy who receives the Ten Commandments?
Ooh! Oh, I'm so glad somebody asked that question. Look at this. This is how I begin with Moshe. Who is my great leader? He's brought up by women. But how does he develop into himself? He goes out and he kills somebody. Wouldn't it be great if Moshe had gone out, seen two people arguing, a Mitzri, and had gone over to the Egyptian? I mean, he could have done so many things. He was an Egyptian prince. Right? Be gone! I always like that word. You know, this seems to say that, you know, in order to become a leader, you have to be one of the guys. You have to be a little macho. It's not exactly my ideal. Why is Moshe doing this? What is going on here? Okay, so now let's have some fun. Because I want to tell you that there's something that was mentioned here, but I'm not so sure everybody picked up on the pattern. It is an incredible pattern. And it will become significant even more later when we get to Sinai. There's something missing here. What did they feel? So I want to tell you that, and I'm reminding you again that I said that, you know, I'm sharing with you the way I read the Bible, and you have to try to look at it from that perspective to understand where I'm coming from. If this book is divine, in addition to the conclusions we came to previously, that maybe that would mean that the words are significant and that there's no repetition without reason, etc., I wonder if it could also mean that words mean a lot more than we think they mean. And I will give you an example. Vayelech Ish, now we're in chapter 2, verse 1. Vayelech Ish mi Beit Levi vayikach et Bat Levi. Anonymous. These two people right now are not the focus yet. The father of Moshe is not the issue and is not one of two things. Either he's not important, which I don't buy, and tradition says that Amram, who was the father of Moshe, was very important, or perhaps more significantly, the Bible wants to de-stress him. They're interested less in the father and more in the mother. So the woman gives birth. Vatera oto ki tovu. And she sees that he's good. Now I mentioned to you, we were talking about, you know, different methodologies in studying Bible. Okay? Here's the continuation of another one. When I learn Torah, I mentioned this to you, I can't just read it. I have to hear it. There's an echo that I should hear in this verse. I'll read it to you in English, and you tell me the echo, okay? And she did see him, that he was good. Yeah? That's creation. In fact, I'll go you one stage further. I told you once, we mentioned it briefly for half a second a moment ago, that numbers are very significant. Now, I'm not going to get deep, deep, deep into the world of numbers, but sometimes I think if I can share with you an idea that just leaves you sort of thinking, you know what, there's a whole level of depth here that I don't yet get, then that's a wonderful thing. Because most people, they sort of pay lip service to the fact that there must be depth, but they never get a chance to open up the door and see that. So I'm going to take you inside a tunnel that's very deep. And the light of the tunnel is incredible. And it might leave you feeling a little frustrated because there's so much more to see. And I'm just going to open it briefly, give you a peek, and then we'll go back on to where we were. But I think it's worth a trip. So what do I mean when I say that numbers are significant? And that not only do I have the ability to learn tremendous amounts from developing a sensitivity to these numbers, but the rabbis, the tradition, seems to have a sensitivity to these numbers as well. So I will tell you an interesting thing. There's a famous commentary, we mentioned him in our Jewish books class on the Bible, called Rashi. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, 1040 to 1105, one of the greatest commentaries in the last 1,000 years. And he wrote a magnificent commentary on the Bible. And Rashi was very interested in developing a relationship with what I call Pshat. Pshat means the context of the verses. People sometimes misunderstand the word Pshat, and they think it means Pashut, simple. What it really means is from the word mufshat, really pashut is the same thing, which means that I draw something out of its context. For example, when Joseph meets his brothers and they strip him of his coat, the language that's used is vayafshitu or vayafshiteu, vayafshitu. They literally strip him of his coat. I can strip a meaning from the verse. And I'll give you my favorite example. Imagine for the moment that I'm at the beginning of Genesis. And then I'm looking at the beginning of Genesis, and I see the famous verses where it says that God said, let there be light. And let's say that I don't know what the word or means. In other words, I look, and if you want, you can look back to the first page of the Bible, and you can see it. It's in verse, but you don't have to. It's in verse 3 and 4 on page 1. Just don't lose your place. Right? So God says, it says, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or. And God said, let there be or. Now, we interpret that as light, but let's say I didn't know that. So I say, and God said, let there be or. What's or? I don't know. I have no way of knowing what or means from that verse. Then I read the next verse, right? Vayar Elokim et ha'or ki tov. And God saw that the or was good. Well, now I've narrowed it down a little. maybe whatever I think is not good would not be Ur. Although you could argue that there's nothing in the world that God created isn't ultimately good, but okay. But it doesn't really help me. Then I see it says, Vayavdel Elokim bein ha'oru v'en ha'choshech. And God did separate between the Or and the darkness. Okay, now I have an idea. And then the next verse it says, Vayikra Elohim la'or yom. And God did call the Or day. V'la'choshech kara laila. And God called the darkness night. Now I can figure out that the word Or means light. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Yeah? So the pshat explanation, the contextual explanation of the word Or is light. Now that's a very dangerous thing. It's a magnificent thing because it's a way of developing a relationship with the verses based on what I see. But it's a dangerous thing because I might come to assume that that's all it means. There are many different levels of meaning in the Bible. If that's called pshat, there's something else called remez. What is light? What does light mean? Of what significance is light to me? What can it mean that God created light? What does that make that light? There's a mystical explanation to that light, that it's something spiritual. That light means that something good is given into the world. Can I have light without a source of light? I wouldn't create light. I would create a sun. The sun gives light. I would create a candle. The candle gives light. But light has no substance. Like, where is the light here? There's light in this room. Where is it? Well, it comes from there. Well, that's the sun. So the sun gives me light. So, you know, okay, so we look at physics, photons and particles and all this. But what does it mean? So the drush, the deeper, for the moment we'll call it, the more mystical, perhaps, explanation of the word light is something much less substantive in a physical sense. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because the same is true in understanding stories. It's interesting. I mentioned to you once that the number 6 is always incomplete. Anywhere you will look in the Bible, anywhere, you will always find that the number 6 is incomplete. The number 7 always means completion within the world. Now that's a very important rule, because it means whenever I see a 6, it means I'm missing something. Or something is missing in that story. For example, there are stories of Esav, who is the brother of Yaakov, where the name Esav is repeated 6 times. So I say to myself, something's wrong here with Esav. In the beginning of creation, there's a magnificent phrase, and God saw that it was good. Now that's a very strange thing for the Bible to say. If God creates it, of course it's good. So what does it mean, God saw it was good? It must be that part of the process of that creation is God seeing good. Let's assume for the moment that we don't understand what that means. I'm not even going to try to touch that. But that's a phrase that I see there. Now here's an interesting one. Guess how many times that phrase appears in the beginning of the story of creation, in the 7 days of creation. How many times?
Six.
Nope. 6. Only 6 times. There are only 7 times in the entire Bible where the phrase, someone sees and it was good, appears. In the entire Bible. This is the 7th. Now that can't be accidental. And that's why, by the way, when you look at the Medrash, when you look at rabbinic allegory, all of a sudden they start talking here about creation. And you don't understand why they're doing it. Because they hear an echo. They hear it. Now I'm not finished yet. I'm going to tell you what they do with it. But just so you understand something incredible, that is the creation of the world. This is the creation of the Jewish people. Even though Abraham may well be considered the first Jew, it is Moshe who brings about the creation of a Jewish people. You know why? Because what is the most significant thing that Moshe does? Pardon? He gives the Torah to the Jewish people. In fact, it's not that Moshe takes us out of Egypt. Because getting out of Egypt is meaningless unless it has a purpose. What do I get out of Egypt for? What's the purpose of freedom? So the purpose of freedom in this case is Torah. It's almost as if to say that the whole world was incomplete until the potential for Torah comes on the scene. That's a tremendous idea. By the way, just as an aside, I mentioned to you Rashi. So Rashi, this commentary, has a magnificent comment. He looks at the story of creation, and in the first time that it says, Vayara Elokim et ha'or ki tov, and God saw the light that it was good. Well, maybe I should do backwards. on this particular verse, Vatera Otoki Tovu, she saw that he was good, that Moshe was good. Rashi has a very strange comment. Now Rashi, you should know, and by the way, this Rashi states himself in his introduction, to his own commentary, Rashi is interested in explaining Pshat. He's interested in developing contextual understandings of the verses. He's not interested in the mystical. He's not interested in delving into the philosophical meaning of life. He wants to know, if this is a word here, what does it mean? Well, I look at a verse over there, I see the word there, and from that word over there, I understand the word here. So Rashi has an unbelievable comment. By the way, one more aside, and this is very, very important. You know what I learned from this whole process that I'm in the middle of expressing to you? We tend to think of the Torah as pieces. Like there's the book of Genesis, and that's one unit. And there's the book of Exodus, that's another unit. But when you begin to develop a sensitivity to this, you realize it's all one story. Exodus and Genesis are created together. They're part of the same story. And I can't separate one from the other. It's one big book, albeit divided into pieces in order to make it manageable. That's fascinating to see. And by the way, if you follow this perception, and you begin to develop a sensitivity to it through understanding what it is, and by the way, notice that these numbers, we're not talking about computers and codes, not that, God forbid, I'm not saying there isn't something to that. We're talking about something that's very easy to see once you're sensitive to it. When you're sensitive to it, if you have a little knowledge of Hebrew and you can read a Hebrew word, you can see how many times the word appears, and you begin to develop sensitivities. Maybe I'll just give you two examples. If I look at the portion of Yitro, which is the portion of the giving of the Torah at Sinai, the beginning of that portion of the week, we're actually going to discuss it in one of our classes here, says, Vayishma Yitro, and Yitro did hear everything that God did to the Jewish people. The word Vayishma, and he did hear, appears 7 times in that portion, in the portion of Yitro. Which tells me, without knowing anything about the story and about who Yitro was, that that's very important. That that's the theme of that portion, hearing. And that's very true. The Shema, hearing. And that's the portion of receiving Torah. Somehow hearing and Torah have a relationship. There's another portion in the book of Numbers, we're going to get to it, this coming Shabbat. So I'm telling you something now that you can notice if you read the portion of the week. And that's the portion known as Balak. It's in Numbers. Balak is a king. He's a negative king. I won't go into his story. But the first verse of this portion is Vayar Balak ben Zippor. And Balak, the son of Zippor, did see whatever, everything God had done. And therefore he decided to go about it a different way in terms of attacking the Jewish people. How many times do you think the word Vayar appears in the portion of Balak? 7 times. The whole portion of Balak is about seeing. Do you understand this? When I start to sense these numbers, I develop a relationship. Now back to Rashi. So Rashi says a very interesting thing on this verse. And again, it's so out of character for Rashi. He quotes a medrash, he quotes a rabbinic legend, an allegory, that what does it mean when Yocheved, when the mother of Moshe, saw that her son was good, the house was filled with light. Right? Yitmalei habitan kula ora, if I'm quoting correctly. The house was filled with light. It's a strange comment. What do you mean? Where do you get that from? Where is that in the verse? What do I do with that? Like when I was younger, I used to read that kind of a comment from Rashi and say, okay, very nice, onwards, because I didn't know what to make of it. Well, what is Rashi saying? So if you look back at the verse at the beginning of Genesis, when it says that God saw that the light was good, same commentary, Rashi, has a phenomenal comment. He says, Vayara lokim et ha'or kitov, and God saw that the light was good. Right? Rashi begins to go into this whole strange perception that this light was so good that it had to be put aside for the future world, the world to come, for the righteous, some kind of a mystical thing that's very out of character for Rashi. What's going on here? What is this? There seems to be some relationship. It seems that Rashi, in the 7th, and a person saw that it was good, is relating to the 1st. And it gets even more interesting. Because if you look at this verse, you begin to get a sense that this verse is a very deep verse. Vatitz peneu shlosha yirachim. She hides him for 3 months. Now that's not the normal word for hiding. The normal word for hiding is lehichabot. When Adam says to God, I was afraid, so I hid in the Garden of Eden, he says, Va'iraki eroma nochi, I was afraid that I was naked. Va'echaveh, and I hid. So why this different verse, which doesn't appear anywhere else? You don't find this verse. This is from the word safon, or safun. Does anybody recognize that word? Where do we have that word, safun? What night of the week? Good, north. Pesach. Right, do you remember this? Kadesh urchatz, karpas yachatz. Maror rachza moti matza, maror korech shulchan orech. Tzafun baret. What is tzafun? Right? Tzafun is where I find the hidden. What was I hidden? I hide a matzah on the night of Passover, and then I go look for it. Very strange thing. The rabbis tell me that what that means is that God is hidden in this world, and I have to look for it. I have to look for a relationship with Hashem. In other words, it's a spiritual hiding. Tzafon, by the way, Tzafon traditionally was where the enemies of Israel came out of, the northland. And it is from Tzafon in the Bible, in the prophets, that redemption will come. Tzafon represents redemption. So Vatitz B'nei, she hid him, has many implications. One last thought. The Hasidim have a field day with this verse. What does it mean, Shlosha Yerachim? 3 months. She hid him for 3 months. Why 3 months? So we have an interesting tradition, which you will not find in the verses. And that is concerning the birthday, the day that Moshe was born. How we know this is an interesting story based on the Talmud. Does anybody know, just out of curiosity, when Moses was supposedly born? Correct. The 7th of Adar. As a matter of fact, there's a tradition that burial societies, for various reasons, fast on the 7th of Adar. There's a tradition in the Talmud. Pardon?
What societies?
Burial societies. We have when someone passes away, so we don't just put them in the ground. There's a whole system in order to purify them and respect for the dead, to clean them, and whatever else it might be. Jews, when they're buried, are put into what's called burial shrouds, which are clothes which are very asexual and sort of cover the body as if to say the body has done its bit, but it's only a vessel, and all sorts of other things. So burial societies fast on the 7th of Adar because that is the birthday of Moshe. And more significantly, right, it is also the death of Moshe. There's a Talmudic discussion that a righteous person dies on the day he's born. If you know anyone, I actually know someone who died on the day, on the Hebrew day that they were born, that's supposed to be a sign of tremendous righteousness. What it means, I don't know. Anyway, if Moshe was born on the 7th of Adar, and according to the verse, she hid him for 3 months, and then all of a sudden she sees he's good. And Rashi says the house was filled with light, which is what it means that she sees he was good. What is 3 months after the 7th of Adar? Adar is the 12th month in the year. So I go back to the first month, which is Nisan, 7th of Nisan, to the second month, 7th of Iyar, to the third month, 7th of Sivan. What is the 7th of Sivan? 7th of Sivan is the date in the Torah when the Torah was given. And that is going to be Moshe's purpose. And what is the light that has the potential to fill the world? Torah. So there's a lot of levels beneath these verses that get very, very deep. Now, why do I share all this with you? In addition, just to giving you a taste. Because, you know, sometimes we're reading verses, and I'm sort of, it's hard for me, like I hold myself back, because there's so many different levels, so much deeper, which are tremendous. Why do I tell you all this? Because I want to now have some fun with one word. And I want to give you a perception of the magnificence that can be contained within one word. I want to show you something. And this can't be random, but what you do with it is up to you. I'll tell you what I do with it. So, she has a child, and she sees that he's good. Okay. And then whatever happens, happens. Okay? The daughter of Pharaoh goes down to wash at the Nile. What happens? How does she save Moshe? What does she do? Before that. Before that. She sees the Teva. Look in verse 5. Same exact word spelled the same exact way. In verse 3, Vatera otoki tovu, she sees he's good. In verse 5, Vatera etai teva, she sees the cradle. Right? And I see this again and again. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details. And by the way, Miriam stands afar so that she can see Moshe. What's going on here? What does Vatera mean? What does it mean to see? There's a very important message that the Torah is giving me here. You see, you can see, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you see. There's a Bob Dylan song, right? Blowing in the Wind. How many times can a man turn his head pretending that he just doesn't see? You know? There's actually a magnificent mitzvah in the Torah that you're not supposed to close your eyes before the aged and the infirm. And the rabbis discuss this. What does this mean? You're sitting in a bus, and you're in the front seat. Now, there are two levels of insensitivity. Level one of insensitivity is that you're sitting in the front on a bus, and an elderly person gets on, who's obviously having difficulty getting on. And you don't even, it doesn't even occur to you that you should get up for them, that you should help them. That's level one of insensitivity. Level two of insensitivity is, in my opinion, much worse. Level two of insensitivity is, I see the old person outside of the bus, and I know that if I'm sitting here and they get up, I can't not get up for an old person. That's horrible. So what do? I close my eyes and pretend I'm asleep. You ever done this on a bus? It's a horrible thing to do. I close my eyes, I pretend I'm asleep. Like, you know, obviously if I'm awake, I would get up. But I'm asleep. That's a much deeper insensitivity. Because it's a sensitivity which is coupled with the knowledge that it's insensitivity. Do I develop a sensitivity to what I see? I took people on a tour yesterday. I'm doing these regular Sunday tours. We were walking, and there's a beggar lady here, Luna, who is, you could call her a rather aggressive person. She sits by the Kotel stairs. And I won't tell you the whole story of how I found her. But I used to walk here, you know, and there's a whole section of people. And I call them the hands. It's like that's what we think of them. We think of them as hands. They don't have faces. They don't have names. They don't have feelings. They don't have personalities. They're just hands. So all I have to do is relate to the hand. So I walk down the street, and there's a hand, and the hand is talking to me. And what is the hand saying? The hand is saying, put a coin in me. So I take my coin and I put it in them, and that's my conversation, and I've done my bit. And very often we don't do this because we have a deep sensitivity to the person who's related to that hand. We do this because we have a deep sense of guilt about not having the conversation that we're supposed to have with the hand. So one day I'm walking through the Jewish quarter, and, you know, when I first started to work here, and usually, you know, I mean, in the winter, so I like to wear a jacket and tie, and in the summer I wear a tie, and sometimes I don't wear a tie, whatever, so I'm walking through and I'm wearing a tie. So that means I'm an American and I have money, right? Because I have a tie up. Go figure, right? So she sort of targeted me a couple times. And, you know, I feel bad. I reach in my pocket, whatever I have in my pocket, you know, 5 shekels, whatever it is. And, of course, you know that you could give more. You know you could give more. And, by the way, halachically, you don't have to give beyond a certain amount. But you do have to give above a certain amount. You don't have a legal right not to give tzedakah at all. But you don't have to give your entire livelihood. So you give 10% is the traditional whatever it is. So you know you could give more. I mean, would it really break your bank if instead of giving her 5 shekels, you gave 10 shekels? So you say to yourself, well, if I give her 5 shekels, then who am I going to give it? Yeah, right. Anyway, so I did this a couple of days. And one day I didn't have any change. And it happened to be that I had some time. And I suddenly started to feel really bad. Like, I passed this person 2-3 times. And for whatever the reason, I was in a rush. You know, you can give a lot more to a hand than a coin. There are lots of things you can give to someone who needs charity beyond the coin. As a matter of fact, I'm willing to bet the 2 shekels you put in her hand is not going to make or break her year. But how many people, when they pass by and give her 2 shekels, actually stop to smile at her? Do you ever stop to think about it? Does anybody, when they're 5 years old, who gets asked the question, what do you want to be when you grow up, answer, I want to be a beggar? That's a hard job. Nobody wants to be a beggar. It's hard to sit up there all day and all night. And it's hard to get over our perception that they're out to get us and to fool us. Because if they are, the joke's on them. It's a hard job. So one particular day, like I said, I wasn't that much in a rush, and I didn't have to ask some change. And I felt bad, and I said, you know what, I can give this person more than a coin. I can give them some time. That's a gift. So I got into this conversation with her. And it just so happened that my youngest daughter, our youngest daughter, Adi, who had been born only 2 months earlier, had a dimple on the lower part of her back, at the bottom, at the base of her spine. And they said to us that it might be that she has what's called tethered cord syndrome. Needless to say, we went frantically to the internet and read up all about tethered cord syndrome, which is the worst thing you can do, and discovered that if in fact it's this, so it could be that, and it could be motor neuron development problems and all sorts of other things. And we went to a doctor. And the doctor said you really should get an ultrasound. Now, an ultrasound for a baby and possibly a CAT scan is not a simple thing. Because you have to, especially a CAT scan, you have to give a general anesthetic. Giving a general anesthetic to a 2-month-old baby is not a simple thing. You know, it's not without its risks. So I was a little nervous about it and somewhat pressured. My wife was absolutely frantic about it. And all this is going through my head. So I remember that there's a verse that says, Karov Hashem le'nishbore lev. God is close to the brokenhearted. And the Talmud actually discusses the fact that God hears the prayers of the downtrodden and the weary and the poor, whatever it means. So I figured, all right, you know what? And I'll be honest with you, I wasn't saying this to her because I really thought, here's my solution. I just thought it'd be a nice thing. You know, one of the nicest gifts you can give to somebody like that is to give them something they can do for you. Right? So that they don't feel they're always taken. So I said, you know, it's funny, my daughter and this and that, whatever. You know, you're a poor person, you have a lot of merit, you give people the opportunity to do mitzvot. Maybe you could say a bracha for my daughter. And I figured, whatever, you know, it's not. So she says to me, well, I'll do you one better. Write her name down on a piece of paper and I'll give it to Rav Kaduri. I said, Rav Kaduri. Now, Rav Kaduri is the most famous Jewish Kabbalist in the whole world, bar none that I know of. He speaks to hundreds of thousands of people. They fly him in by helicopter. He's 107 years old. He's one of the mentors of the whole Shas movement. Tremendous Torah scholar. He is probably the greatest Torah scholar and mystic in the whole Sephardic world and probably in the world. If you really do want to get to speak to Rav Kaduri, you have to wait like 2, 3, 4 days. And if you're lucky, maybe you'll get it. So I said, Rav Kaduri? She said, yeah, I'm very close with his son. And I go to see him all the time. So I said, okay, you know, what do you say to something like that? So we had actually an appointment to get an ultrasound not that long after. And I wrote the name down. And don't get me wrong, my faith in Hashem and my relationship with Hashem, I'm, you know, I may be an emotional, but I'm an emotional rationalist, an arch rationalist. And I don't believe, I mean, those of you who came to my lecture last Wednesday night know that you have to do your bit. It's not about, but if somebody comes to you with an offer like that, especially considering the way it developed in a relationship, so fine. So she, the next time I saw her, she said, by the way, I gave it to Rav Kaduri. And he said, you know, you should, I forget what it was, I think you should say, there's a certain mizmor of Tehillim, a certain psalm, whatever you should say, and don't worry about it. They're not going to find anything in the ultrasound. So I figured, if nothing else, at least this could be a gift I could give to my wife. Then I thought, maybe this is a mistake, because then if they do find something, right, so it'll be disappointing to her. But then I said, so what? You know, it's a week where she won't be, you know, maybe the pressure that we feel affects our children. Anyway, so fine. So I told my wife the story. I said, look, I don't know what to do with it, but you know what? How can you go wrong by saying a psalm every day? That's a good thing. I'm studying Torah. Wonderful. What do you lose? Fine. So sort of reserving myself, not having fallen into the trap. I'm cleverer than they are. I do this. Needless to say, we go to the ultrasound. In fact, they found nothing, whatever it is. But the story gave me a lot of perspective. Do we really see? Or do we just pretend to see? Yocheved apparently sees something. The Bible makes a point of saying it. There's something that she sees. And seeing, by the way, is not only perception. She sees there's something special about this baby. She sees that she can't keep the child anymore, but she can't allow this child to disappear from the world. She has to do what she can. Now here comes, by the way, lesson number 2. Because you would think that if Yocheved is this tremendously righteous woman, the mother of Moses, that what she should be doing at this point is getting into a lotus position with her hands on her knees, meditating into a deep trance and praying to God. God will solve this. If God wants the Torah to be given and God wants Moshe to be saved, then God. But that's not what she does. She makes a basket and she puts the basket on the Nile as if to say, on the one hand, I recognize the fact that Moshe is at the mercy of the forces of nature, and that God controls those forces of nature, but I have to do my bit. And in this case, her bit is making that basket and putting it on the Nile. But I would suggest to you a stage further. How do I know if Yocheved really sees? How do I know that the sight of Yocheved is a level of sensitivity that has meaning? You know when I know that she's really developed a sense of sensitivity? When I see Miriam. Because you don't know whether I'm an ethical person. For me, I can have a great line, and you could all buy it. But you know when you'll know if I'm an ethical person? If you watch my children. If my children are so ethical, then I have to be an ethical person. Because you can't fool children. So what does Miriam do? And by the way, what does the word Miriam mean? Minyam, from the sea, water, the ocean. Now there's a tremendous difference between a river and an ocean. A river has direction. A river flows one way. An ocean is a reservoir of strength. So I won't go into the significances and the differences, but that's Miriam. In fact, if you think about it, Miriam goes a stage farther. Vatetatsev, she stands herself opposite. She says, what do you mean? You haven't done your bit yet. There's more to do. It's not enough just to put the baby on the Nile. You can actually jump in the Nile. Is it ever enough? Is my sensitivity ever enough? Can I always go beyond? And that's Miriam. There's a tremendous lesson here. Because the birth of Moshe is created in the realm of Ri'iyah, of sensitivity. What is the ultimate level of sensitivity? We spoke about this last week. That Ri'iyah turns into Yir'ah, Yir'at Hashem. And I told you that Yir'ah doesn't mean fear the way some translate it as, but it's the same root of Ri'iyah. Yir'ah, which really is Yera'eh, is as opposed to seeing, it's he will see, they will see, future tense, that there's something even greater to see. It's only through my being sensitive to my fellow human being that I can truly develop a sensitivity to the fact that there's something even greater than that, a loving God. But now go a stage further. Because now look at Moshe. And this is why I think that this has to be the understanding of this story. Moshe is brought up in the house of Pharaoh. By the way, one last comment here before I continue the thought. And that is the daughter of Pharaoh. It would seem that this story is a paradigm for what the world can be. If I am sensitive as a human being, and if my sensitivity, not because I lecture it to the world, not because I tell everybody what to do, but because I am such a model of ethic. Remember, we spoke about this last week. If that affects the world around me, if the daughter, Miriam, Minyam, what comes forth from that sea, from that reservoir of sensitivity, if it too becomes sensitive, then it has the ability to affect the whole world, even the daughter of Pharaoh. And so the ultimate level of sensitivity, which finally succeeds in saving Moshe, comes from the daughter of Pharaoh. And it's interesting that it occurs in the midst of idolatry, in the midst of the Nile. There is no point in human existence at which sensitivity, ethics, a relationship with my fellow human being doesn't make a difference. And now watch what happens. Because now Moshe is brought up in the house of Pharaoh. What do I expect from a Moshe brought up in the house of Pharaoh? Well, you could argue it's a Moshe brought up in the house of Pharaoh, but he suckles at Yocheved's breasts. And by the way, what does it mean to nurse? That the baby at the mother's breast is the arch symbol of mercy. So he's growing up in two worlds. He's growing up in the world of Pharaoh, of Egypt, of cruelty. He's seeing the depths. I mean, what does it mean to live in a society where baby children, where infants are thrown to their deaths? That's the depths that a human being can sink to. It doesn't get more evil than that. And he grows up with that world on the one hand, and with the tremendous sensitivity on the other hand. And it's interesting, by the way, how is this sensitivity reflected? The mother, the daughter, and the daughter of Pharaoh. Three women. The woman in the Torah, bar none, reflects sensitivity. It's not accidental that the woman gives birth to the child. The child begins within the framework of sensitivity, of mercy. That's where the Jewish people begin. That's where each human being begins. I have to begin from the framework of sensitivity. That, by the way, is the power of women. There is one suggestion, and I won't go into this because we really don't have time, but if this perks your interest and you want to follow up on this, you'll let me know. That the reason that there's a difference in terms of the relationship that a woman has to prayer, to tefillah, and the relationship a man has to tefillah, is in one area, and that's the area of minyan. Right? You've heard this, that there's a quorum, 10 men get together. What does it mean? What does it mean that all of a sudden there's a 10th man, and now I pray differently? I add something. Something's changed. What does that mean? It doesn't just mean that I had 9, and now I added 1, and I have 10. The additional 10th man changes 9 individuals into a community. The idea of minyan is developing sensitivity within a community. Prayer in and of itself is a development of sensitivity. Prayer within a community means that I have to develop that sensitivity to my fellow human being within a community. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch suggests that in this particular area, man, and I'm not getting into now you or me or whatever, because when I say the word man and woman here, I also mean the mystical concept that lie behind that. So it's a lot deeper. But just, this is as a food for thought. You shouldn't walk away thinking, now I'm going to get a response to this difficult question. What you should think is, this is an interesting direction to pursue, because I don't have the time to, just so you understand. Don't think this is what I have to say on the topic. But Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch suggests that in this particular area, it is actually man who needs to develop this sensitivity much more than woman. And that is why man is given this obligation. It's interesting that a man has an obligation to pray within a community to develop that sensitivity, because the dangers of man not having that sensitivity. And Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch goes so far as to suggest that because a woman carries life within her, she has an inherent ability to develop sensitivity that man doesn't have. That's a very interesting thing. And I'm not talking about from a physical perspective or a psychological perspective, but that somehow mystically there seems to be a difference. And don't misunderstand this to mean, by the way, better or worse. So now getting back to what we were saying in the story of Moshe. What happens to Moshe? Because Moshe, on the one hand, is going to be this leader. It's crucial. If he's going to be able to communicate Torah, there's a certain hardness to the concept of Torah, of law, of direction. It's crucial that that sensitivity to my fellow human being doesn't get lost. That's why Moshe begins from this perspective. And then what happens? Then Moshe leaves the world of women and he goes out into the world of men. And he meets two men, an Egyptian and a Jew. And then he meets another two men. And all of these men, and then he has a conflict with Pharaoh, the third man situation. What is it that Moshe carries into that world of men? Look. Vayar ish Mitzri. He sees the Egyptian hitting. Look at verse 12. Vayifen ko vako, and he looks back and forth. Vayar ki ein ish. He sees that there isn't someone there. And then the next day again. Vayar, he sees. In other words, Moshe has developed that sensitivity of sight. By the way, when does Moshe finally develop his relationship with God? A chapter later, he's in the desert, and he sees Asurana ve'er'eh. I will turn and I will see. The story of the development of Moshe, the story of the potential that Judaism has, is the development of sight. Not physical sight, but spiritual sight. Sight of sensitivity. Sight of compassion. That's the story of the development of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's an incredible, incredible idea. Moshe ultimately will go up on the mountain. That's a very dangerous thing. I think I mentioned to some of you, but in case I didn't. What's the first thing that God says to Moshe Rabbeinu? I mean, here's Moshe. And here's God. So what am I going to say? This is my introduction to Moshe. Here, Moshe, I am the Lord thy God. That would be a great one. Or how about Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord thy God. I know your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Tremendous, right? What does he say? Could you take your shoes off, please? That's what he says. Shal na lecha me'al raglecha. Take off your shoes. It's a little strange. I got this picture of like God. He's sitting at this little bush, right? And he's got one of those little, you know those things that they measure your feet on in a shoe store? Right? And he's sitting at this bush. He said, could you take your shoes off, please? I want to measure you for the leadership role. It's very strange. So what does it mean? You, Moshe, are now entering a different realm. You're entering a spiritual realm that you can only begin to enter when you first learned that sensitivity, that sight in the physical world. See, people think, how do I develop a relationship with God? I got to leave the world behind. Judaism says the opposite. Judaism says sanctity, holiness, a relationship with God. Kedusha, holiness, is not, by the way, some spiritual, mystical. Holiness means I'm closer to God. So how do I develop a relationship with God? Not by leaving the world, by seeing God in the world. Now, if I can see God in a fig leaf, if I can see God in a flower, then how can I not see God in a human being? How could you ever look at a human being and not see the incredible world that every human being is? The incredible spiritual potential. The majesty of creation in a human being. You know, you walk through this courtyard. And every tour, it's the only thing I do every time I do a tour, in any tour that I do. Whenever we walk through this courtyard, right? I did it with you guys. We stop, we take a look at that pillar, see the majesty of the tree. And everybody looks, majesty, what a tree. Majesty of a tree? A tree is nothing compared to a human being. A human being is created in the image of God. This the creative energy, the majestic beauty within the human being. If I can't see that in my fellow human being who stands before me, how can I ever find God? So Moses achieved that. He goes into Midian. And he gets to a well. And there's all these men, and there's a girl, and she's a Midianite girl. She's an idolatress. She's not even Jewish. Her name is Tzipora. And he puts his life on the line. He does this whole hero thing, and he rolls the stone, and he fights the shepherds. For who? For some Midianite slut. Because he sees. She's a human being. She's a world. That's my goal. That's a tremendous thing. So now Moshe gets to God, and now he's getting to the next stage. He's going to develop an intense relationship with Hashem. But what's the purpose? Moshe goes up on Sinai. How could you ever leave Sinai? How could he ever come down? How could you ever, you know, I remember our wedding. It was the most incredible experience, the day of your wedding. It's just, it's like you're in a different world. It's surreal. And you know, it was the easiest fast I ever had. It's a tradition, it's a magnificent tradition to fast on the eve of your wedding. I remember before, and I was thinking, like, you know, it's just a fast on the eve of my wedding. I want to enjoy my wedding. But, you know, it's a custom, so I did it fine. I didn't even feel it. Who feels? You know, Rabbi Saul Salanter, I never understood this line until the day of my wedding. Rabbi Saul Salanter once said, on Tisha B'Av, which is the anniversary of the destruction of the temple, I fast because I'm so sad. Who could eat on such a day? On Yom Kippur, I fast. Yom Kippur is the day par excellence when I come close to God because I'm so happy. Who could eat on such a day? The only time I ever really felt that was the day of my wedding. Who cares about food? It was an unbelievable day. I was so excited. There was so much going through my head. Your life is going to change. You know, there's a beautiful custom. You don't see your bride. You don't see each other for that whole week. So by the time you get to the wedding, and then they finally bring you, you know, they dance you. You sit at a tish. You're at a table. You sign the marriage contract, whatever, you know, all this stuff. And then they're singing. And then they sort of walk you. All of a sudden, you know, and I wasn't nervous at all. I knew this was a girl for me and everything. The only time it hit me for a second was all of a sudden they stand you up. And my father grabs one arm, my father-in-law grabs the other, and they sort of march me, right? And I'm like, wait a second here! Whoa! Right? And then all of a sudden, and all these guys are dancing in front of you, right? And there's a beautiful custom, which is actually based on the story of Jacob, and the bride, the reed, is sitting in a chair, and you go over and you see that it's her, and then you sort of veil her, because there was a whole story with Jacob, that Laban, his father-in-law, tricked him into marrying the other sister, etc. And I always thought that's such a strange custom. It's just strange custom. I have to know it's her. What do you think? First of all, I can see through the veil. Second of all, if she didn't have any sisters. But second of all, if someone else could stand under the chuppah with me, and I wouldn't know it was Dorit, then something's wrong. Then I shouldn't be marrying. Something's wrong. So what is that? And they dance you up. And I want you to know it's the most incredible feeling. Because all of a sudden the guy, they have a beautiful custom, a lot of the guys here, and sort of they dance you up, like with song. It's this intense, overwhelming emotion of joy and happiness. And then, as they get close to the bride, so they break, and they make this column. And they put up their hands like this, sort of like a bridge, and you walk under their hands. Right? Now, I thought this was just a nice, cute idea. Later, when I was a rabbi, you know, and I do weddings by myself, so I started reading up all these things. I found it's a very old, it's a Hasidic custom, it's a magnificent custom. You're walking underneath the hands of friends who love you. That's how you start your marriage. It's tremendous. And you walk up to your wife, and you have to look at her. You see her. And for one moment, and you haven't seen her in a week, so it's an incredible moment. Can you imagine not seeing the person you're going to marry the week before you marry her? That's incredible. And then all of a sudden at the wedding, it's incredible. So what's this custom saying? You want to have a marriage with this woman? You always have to be able to see her. It's a tremendous idea. So God says, you're going to come up on Sinai. I want you to see me. I want you to be able to develop a sensitivity, a constant realization and understanding of our relationship in this world. That's why Moshe is the only prophet who sees God face to face. There's this relationship. But you know what? All that is meaningless if it stays up here in the mountain. You've got to take it back down. And so right at the beginning of the journey, he says, take your shoes off. Feel the earth. feel this world, because remember that as high up as you get, this is the goal. I want to tell you something. This is an incredible thing. To be sitting here and studying Torah. What a magnificent thing. We're delving into a tradition that's 3,000 years old. We're studying now what our great-great-grandparents and great-great-great-grandparents, I promise you, hundreds of your ancestors, your direct ancestors, your great-great-grandfather, if you run into him up in heaven now, like, think about it. Like, what would you talk to him about? Say, you know, I had a nice car. Favus is a car, right? You say, well, you know, have you ever read Dostoevsky? Who is Dostoevsky? What are you talking about? You say, oh, Moshe, Shmot, Sinai, Seeing. Oh, because you know he knows what you're talking about. That's a tremendous thing. That's what this is about. The development of a leader in the Jewish people is a whole different level of leadership. Look at the story. It's not about him going out with a sword and conquering the enemy. And I want to tell you something. It's interesting that before Moshe kills the Egyptian, it says, Vayifen kova kova yar. He sees, he understands. You know, it's not always so easy to be able to be sure that an action is cruel or incruel. And I'll tell you, we'll finish with this, I'll tell you one last story. Because there is no other example that I can think of, for me personally. When I was in, we were in Beirut. And doing a tank patrol in Beirut is a very difficult thing. Beirut is the capital of Lebanon. It's an incredibly tragic city. Because you can see how beautiful it must have been. And it's been torn by civil war since, I think, 1975. The Christians and the Muslims have been fighting each other. The Druze got involved. Anyway, we're in Beirut. Anyway, fighting in the city is a very difficult thing because, you know, I was a commander of a platoon of tanks. So a tank has awesome firepower. It's a tremendous responsibility. And a tank is meant to be out in the open where it can run. It's got a 105mm cannon. It's got three heavy machine guns. 52 tons of armor bearing down on the enemy with smoke and noise and fire and phosphorus grenades and mortar. It's an awesome machine. When you're in a city, first of all, most often in the streets, you can't spread your tanks out, so they're one behind the other. The only tank that can really fire is the one in front. Second of all, you can't really fly. You're a sitting duck. And most of all, you're in a civilian population. And I want to tell you, there's something in the pit of your stomach from the minute you go out on patrol until the minute you get back that I never felt when I was out in the field. Because you really don't know what is going to happen that day. So we're driving down the street in Beirut on a patrol, and I see a familiar tube. When you're in officers course in the Israeli army, the topic, one of the two topics they take most seriously is what's called Toda, which means recognizing the weaponry and the tools of the enemy. If I see a helicopter bearing down on my tank unit at 5 kilometers away, I don't have time to think about whether it's a Syrian helicopter or an Israeli helicopter. I have to recognize it right away. If I see an enemy tank, so if I would show you different tanks, you wouldn't know, is it a Syrian tank, a Jordanian tank? You have to know that backwards and forwards. Because God forbid that you should fire on one of your own, and God forbid that you shouldn't fire on one of the enemies. So every Friday, in officer's course, they give you this comprehensive test on all of these different weapons and whatever, and they give you a lesson. If you don't pass the test, you don't get out for Shabbat. It's that simple. So you pass the test. So you have to know this stuff cold. And there's one image that every person in a tank has ingrained into his mind, and that's the image of an RPG. RPG is a handheld anti-tank weapon, which is a tube, basically, with a rocket at the end that's carried on the shoulder. It takes about 2 seconds to aim it and fire it. And you don't have time to think, what is that thing sticking out? So we're driving down the street in Beirut. And from around the corner, I see this tube. And this second passes over you. Now, normally, when you're in a situation like that, so, you know, if you spot the enemy, so there's all sorts of commands that you give, you know, totach, tvach kavi, gunner, you know, battle range, there's a certain range which is always in the computer, right? Tank out, tank, you know, and you, he's got a very narrow scope, which, you know, is magnified. And what you have to do, because think about looking through something like this, I can look at you, but I don't see what's over here. So I've got to bring him, I've got an override control, it's called a mashbet. I can override his controls of the gun, and I can bring the gun to the general area, and you practice this all the time with your gunner, so that you can lean down, grab this control, bring him exactly where you want him to be seeing. Right? Because you don't have time to go down and look through your scope, right? But sometimes you don't have time for that. And this is one of those situations. You don't have time to bring the gunner on and have him aim in sight. Because by that time, you're talking about 200 meters, 100 meters, you're not going to be here. So I reach down for a second and grab the mashbet, and I look back, and I see it's a kid. He couldn't have been more than 6 or 7 years old. Now, I'd heard about these kids, but I'd never seen one before. They called them RPG kids. The Palestinians trained children to fire RPGs, banking on the sensitivities of Israeli soldiers to hesitate. And more than once, this hesitation cost the tank crew its life. So they told us about this, and they told us about it again, and they'd ingrained it into us. If you see such a thing, you just have to fire, you don't have to think about it. And we had a discussion about it, you know, beforehand, you know, if you see such a thing, what do you think? And we would debate it. And so we'd all had this debate and resolved it in our minds, so that technically we knew what we were going to do. But you're looking at a 6 or 7 year old kid. And you know that this kid is not responsible for holding that RPG. You also know that if you don't fire your gun, that you could be responsible for the deaths of 4 of your men, and maybe more. So you don't really have a choice. And so you fire. I want you to know there are many, many things that I can forgive in this world. I don't know that I'll ever be able to find it in me to forgive them for making me do that to a child. And the image of a child being shattered by a 105mm tank shell is a horrible sight. So was I sensitive or insensitive? I mean, I killed a 6-year-old boy. So was that insensitive? Or did I have a heightened sensitivity to the 3 men who were in my command? And I want you to know something. Life isn't full of simple answers. What the Torah is telling me is, the question has to plague me. That's a tremendous idea. What does Moshe do before he hits that mitzri? Vayifen kovako. He looks back and forth by Yar and he sees. So what does it mean that he looks back and forth? I'll tell you what I think it means. And the rabbis have many different opinions. There's a mystical explanation. He looks into the future of this Egyptian and sees no good will come of him. And all sorts of different questions. I'll tell you what I think it means. I think he looks back and forth. And this is the contextual. And that's not to the exclusion of the mystical understanding. But he's got a Jew. He's got an Egyptian. And he's looking back and forth. Because he has to choose. Now he makes a decision. Because the lack of a decision, well, that's a decision too. Then the Jew dies. And it's interesting, God doesn't tell him what to do. There are decisions we have to make in life that are our decisions. It doesn't mean anything if God gives me a blueprint and a plan for every time how to be sensitive and where to be sensitive. My sensitivity has to be heightened and developed to such an extent that I struggle with the issue and I make my conclusions. If I come to a conclusion based on that thought process, then I can't be wrong. If I come to a conclusion without that thought process, then I can't be right, even if I'm right. That's what the Torah is telling me. That's the develop of a relationship with the world around me. And that's what gives forth the ability to the Jewish people to receive the Torah. I think that that is the lesson of Moshe. There's obviously a lot more to find in this story. Food for thought.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.